is this your life? Are you going to change your life, or are you going to, as the metaphor goes, drown in the basement? Welcome, welcome, welcome back, everybody, to No Script, an unscripted conversation about theater's best scripts. I'm Jacob, that's Jackson. We are here today to discuss another great script, another great piece of American theater from two American theater giants, a musical. We're here today to do a musical, which is always fun. Today we are discussing Caroline or Change by Tony Kushner and Jeanine Tessery.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, happy to be chatting about today. Interestingly, that we have in the lineup of the season two musicals right next to each other. Doesn't always happen. And excited for the chance to chat about this one. This one just has so many great songs. It's such a great story. And is like... Interestingly, we often talk about kind of plot and what moves for characters in musicals, and sometimes that's hard to do. I don't feel like that's going to be a problem with this script.
I totally agree. I was blown away. I mean, I've encountered Caroline or Change before, but coming back to it this time, I was really blown away by it as a piece of drama writing. I'm not always blown away by musicals for their like good character drama, plot-based, you know, action. Driven stories. That's not always what musicals do really well. They do other things really well, but not always that particularly really well. But this does. And yeah. This could be a play, like a really interesting play with interesting characters and interesting problems. And then you just add on top of it the incredible music, and it's just a full package.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, it's like no one part is lessened by another.
Yes.
The music is awesome, the plot is awesome, the characters are awesome. So yeah, excited for the chance to chat about it today.
And part of that is because Caroline or Change is what they call, I say they, and I was going to say we, but I realized that I don't call this thing. I'm not a musical expert of any kind. So they, the experts out there, call this a through-composed musical. The idea being that it is sort of one continuous piece of developing music rather than with breaks and repetitive choruses, repetitive verses. So apparently they say, and I'm speaking from ignorance here, but that like a through composed piece of music does not have repeating verses. So when you come back to a new verse, a new set of lyrics, the chorus, whatever, you're not coming back to the same melody. It's always moving forward, always changing, always developing. And I didn't know that before encountering Caroline or Change this time, but that actually in my brain sort of clicked into place, like the kind of music that it is. I remember one time, Jackson, we were talking about Sondheim, and we were I think roundly chastising some reviewer who said something to the effect of like, Sondheim is lame because the songs aren't hummable. Basically, the idea that the Sondheim music is too complex, too non-melodic at times, and that's not what people want. And as we were listening to Caroline or Change, I actually had flashes of that. It felt Sondheim to me in that it's not really... Like, I couldn't, at least, and I'm like, I would call myself minimally musical. I would have a hard time singing along to Caroline or Change. And I think part of it is that it's not, the music is not very repetitive, but to me, that ends up feeling more like the action is progressing, more like a play or a good movie or just a good piece of acting, because I'm not distracted by this idea that we're coming back to melodies that were there before. It just feels like a really good story where instead of speaking, the characters happen to be singing.
Yeah, I know, I agree. And the other thing that I noticed in it was because you're doing so much work in the actual lyrics themselves and never changing and always progressing it along, there's a lot of like really interesting rhyme schemes and things like that. And also it like because you're not like being swept up, you are being swept up emotionally as well because the music is awesome and all that and the characters are going on a great journey. But because you're not kind of in the repetition of it, you also have, I had this weird engagement of my brain as well, because I'm like, not only am I like listening to the stirring music and resting kind of on my laurels, receiving a refrain over and over, but instead I'm listening intently to what the lyrics are saying because they matter so much. And so the engagement was really different that way too.
No, I think you're right that it does put the emphasis more on the lyrics and more on the lyrics as dialogue, like as yeah. negotiation. The other thing that it does, which is similar to other musicals where like 95% of the show is music, right? Like it's not dialogue scenes and then a short song, dialogue scenes and a short song. This is this play, this musical is all music. It's music through. And yeah. what that does is put the emphasis on when there's not music. So when right. the music cuts out and someone just speaks, I immediately go, this is crucial. Whatever's about to happen is important. And I think in like more, I don't know that traditional is the right word, but in the other kind of musical where it's mostly dialogic and then there's songs, it puts the emphasis on the songs. The important stuff happens in the music. And it's not like important stuff doesn't happen in the music here, but when the music cuts out and a character just speaks, I immediately know that it's important. Something For crucial sure. is happening in a weird sort of reversal. Sort of yeah, like yeah, Les Mis, right? Like it feels like in yeah. Les Mis, when the music cuts out, somebody's about to die.
Right. Yep. Les Mis, Hamilton, all of these yeah, all yeah, these yeah, ones yeah. that like have primarily music all the time. When there's spoken lines, it's impactful for sure. It also has the benefit of meaning that the album of yes. this play, both the original cast recording and the revival, as we'll hear about in a minute, is a fair representation of the play. You're not missing out on large pieces of dialogue, etc. So it was great in the reading slash listening of this play to be able to just listen through the whole thing. I almost recommend you going and checking it
yeah.
out.
Yes.
Because it's, I mean, ahead of the conversation, if you want to kind of know everything that we're going to be talking about, it's a great way to engage the play. It's on Spotify. It's I'm sure it's wherever music is sold, etc. You can find multiple recordings that are the full play, which is great.
Yeah, both Broadway productions have cast recordings that, yeah, are just the full thing. There's very, very short snippets of stuff that's skipped, but really, as with, you know, it's sort of like listening through Les Mis, you really get the whole thing, which is amazing. You're able to sit and experience like an audio version of this story.
Yeah.
Now, I will say, with this musical, boy, it is confusing. Like, this musical has so much like singing that is not done by I guess human characters in the show.
Sure.
Right? Like yep. who is that? Why are they yep. singing? What is that? Well, actually that's just the radio. But the radio yep. is people, of course, we'll talk about all that, and we're as you can tell, we're buzzing. Caroline
we're,
Change.
We're ready to go.
It's yeah. so awesome. You should definitely check it out. Listen through. You'll be moved. It's just an incredible story. I'm gonna rant and rave later about the way in which this play is written, and I'm gonna catch myself saying play, I think, a lot, because it feels to me a lot like just a well-written play.
For sure.
Exciting thing.
Yeah, we're going to jump into the conversation here in just a minute, but as we always do before we jump into the conversation, we wanted to take a second and thank all of our patrons over at patreon.com/noscriptpodcast. Thank you all so much for being patrons of the show, for helping this show exist. We couldn't do it without you, so we really appreciate y'all. If you're looking for a way to help out the show, Patreon is a great way to do that. We love getting to do this show. We love getting to have these conversations. We're coming up on the end of our season 12, and we got another whole season lined up and ready to go. So we're excited to continue the conversation. It is, alas, not a free endeavor. There are costs associated with running a podcast, and the patrons over at patreon.com/noscriptpodcast make it happen. Thank you all so much if you've already head over there. If you are looking for a way to just join the show a little bit more, whether you're a first-time listener and liking what you're hearing, or a long-time listener and are ready to kind of engage in a new way, Patreon is a great way to do that. We have a number of patron-only posts and access to scripts that we're doing ahead of time, all sorts of fun stuff over there, different tiers of patronship, the lowest one being just $1 a month, and that $1 amount per month helps us out enormously. So thank you to everyone who has already made the decision to become patrons, and if you're looking for a way to help out the show, head on over to patreon.com/noscriptpodcast, and we will see you over there.
And now back to the script.
Here we go.
Hey, okay, so Carolina Change, of course, by Tony Kushner and Jeanine Tessery. We've done pieces by Tony Kushner and Jeanine Tessery before. Tony Kushner, of course, famous for Angels in America. And I want to take just a moment to we've already done Jeanine Tessery, but I want to acknowledge how stinking profound Jeanine Tessery is. I mean, listen to this list of projects. And these are just musical. I mean, she does a bunch of other stuff, but just like straight out Broadway musical type stuff. Thoroughly Modern Millie, Carolina Change, Shrek, Fun Home, Soft Power, a musical that's really big right now, Kimberly Akimbo. I mean, it occurred to me that since the passing of Sondheim, is there working right now, still alive and working, a more like influential, profound composer than Jeanine Tessery, who just doesn't get talked about that much? And maybe that's like ignorant of me, and maybe in other circles, people are really talking about Jeanine Tessery all the time. But I don't feel that that is true. And that's just shocking to me. I mean, she is influencing music in a comparable way to Sondheim. And that's blasphemous, yeah. I know. But I really believe that. I'd looked through current working Broadway musical composers. And again, this is not really totally my area. So if I leave out somebody obvious, I apologize. I'm not really intending to offend anybody. But here are the names I found that I thought were even in the same ballpark, that might even kind of be on the same tier. Alan Menken, maybe. I'd say that's a maybe to me. Lin-Manuel Miranda, I would say Lin-Manuel Miranda is maybe even more popular, although perhaps less influential, and then Jason Robert Brown. Those are the only names I could come up with that I could even like say were in that realm of just how much work and the number of those musicals that are like major musicals of the 21st century is incredible. I mean, even something like Shrek. Anybody you know that's listened to Shrek has probably said something to the effect of like, that score has no business being as good as it is for Shrek the musical. I mean, that's like the general perception. And I don't know. I don't feel like Jeanine Tessery gets the credit that she deserves for what she does.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the so many of the awards, the really interesting projects, like bringing Twelfth Night in and things like that, like this. Yes. So many cool things. And excited that we are getting to return to her work today.
Totally. And of course, Tony Kushner is, you know, who Tony Kushner is. Amazing. And I will say, even though it's a musical, this does feel like a Tony Kushner project. I mean, at various points, the moon sings when JFK dies in this musical. The bus comes crashing in and the stage direction is like, apocalyptic hell gates are opening for this bus. I mean, if that doesn't sound like Tony Kushner, I don't know what does. That is certainly in the realm. So this musical first began workshops in 1999 at the Public Theater off Broadway. George C. Wolfe, the incredible George C. Wolfe, who we've discussed a number of times, playwright of the Colored Museum, directed Angels in America, directed Susan Laurie Park's Top Dog Underdog, major figure. He directed several workshops at the Public across the next couple of years until this musical finally opened off Broadway in 2003 at the Public. It then transferred to Broadway very quickly afterwards at the Eugene O'Neill Theater and ended up being nominated for 6 Tonys. And the actor who played Emmy ended up winning a Tony for featured actress. It then had a very nice regional theater life, 2004, Amundsen Theater in L.A., 2005, Kern Theater in San Francisco. Some of the original cast were in those productions, but it was in 2006 that it got to the National Theater in London. Not quite on the West End yet. I know it seems strange that the National Theater is not considered the West End, but I don't do European theater stuff, so I don't know. That's just how it is. 2006, National Theater in London. It won the Olivier Award for Best New Musical there. And then again, back to regional theater. Theater scene in America, 2008, the Court Theater in Chicago. Sorry, I skipped 2006, Studio Theater in D.C. The Court Theater in Chicago production won 4 Jeff Awards, which is a big deal regionally. 2008, Center Stage in Baltimore. 2009, at the Guthrie. 2010, Gallery Players in Brooklyn. 2011, the Human Race Theater in Ohio. 2012, Syracuse Stage in New York. 2012, Acting Stage in Toronto, which was a heavily awarded production. Something called the Creative Cauldron in Virginia in 2016. and then what has caused its recent surge. The 2017 UK revival began at a festival, ended up transferring to the Hampstead Theatre, ended up transferring to the West End at the Playhouse Theatre. That West End production ended up going to Broadway. The 2021 Broadway revival by Roundabout Theatre Company. Of course, previews were set for 2020, March 2020, and it seems like we've come to this date many a time. That ended up closing, of course, until it was eventually picked back up again in October 2021 to have its wonderful Broadway run. In 2020, to step back before the pandemic, a group called the West Coast Black Theater Troupe in Sarasota, Florida. The West Coast, I assume, must reference the West Coast of Florida. That's the only thing I can think to be the West Coast Theater Troupe. And then March and April 2024, just I suppose when this episode is coming out, it will have just closed Actors Playhouse at the Miracle Theater in Florida. It's had a round full life of regional Broadway West End runs. It's just a hair over 20 years old now, but still so relevant, so powerful. Many of the cast interviews talk about one of the major sort of political things that happens in the musical is the toppling of a Confederate soldier statue. And again, this was like, you know, premiered in 2003. And in 2024, we are, you know, as a culture, working on dealing with, grappling with the toppling of Confederate statues across America. So really relevant, really interesting, you know, great life. Tony Kushner and Jeanine Tessari basically can do whatever they want. Maybe they don't feel that way, but I certainly feel that way. So West End and Broadway are the place for their stuff. So that's not surprising in any way, but still hats off to them for a great life of Carolina change.
Yes, indeed. So we're going to jump into the conversation here real quick, or rather return to the conversation after our conversation before. But I'm going to give you just a brief synopsis of this one, and we'll jump into the conversation. This play takes place in Lake Charles, Louisiana in 1963. And if that's kind of amorphous to you, the big deal in that year, certainly Martin Luther King is doing work at this time. The civil rights movement is enacted in this time. But the event that it is particularly pertinent and about within the scope of this play is JFK is assassinated in 1963. The play takes place over the course of like November, December, right around that time frame. Like the first day, pretty much, we get certainly the first act, we'll say, just to be 100% sure, we get word that JFK has died, has been assassinated. So that's your kind of historical setting for this play. And the sort of like zoomed in focus of this play is on this family. There's Caroline Thibodeau, who works as a kind of housekeeper slash maid in the house of the Gelmans. And the Gelmans are a family the Gelmans, Stuart Gelman is from here in the area of Louisiana, but he has a lot of connections up north as well. They're a Jewish family, they have recently gone through a tragedy. Betty, Stuart's wife, and Noah's mother, who's going to be an important character as we go along through this, Noah, the young son of Stuart and Betty. Betty has died. She's died of cancer, likely ascribed to a lot of smoking, she has recently died, not too long ago. And In the course of just a short amount of time, Stuart has gone ahead and remarried Rose, who is a friend, Rose Stopnick, whose family is from up north, kind of in New York area, and she's kind of transplanted down to here. In that time, Noah has kind of continued to grieve appropriately so, and he's kind of continued his relationship with Caroline. Now, Caroline is her realm primarily is this basement laundry room, where she is in. Often she is focused on the laundry a lot of the day, and that's when Noah comes down and hangs out with her. They share cigarettes.
To be fair, I don't think he smokes them. I think he just lights them for her.
It is
strange.
Yeah. For sure. And we find out that Caroline did share cigarettes with Betty as well. So she is kind of ongoing in grief of that as well. Now, into all that kind of grief is thrown the newness of Rose, who is kind of new to the family. We have the grandparents, Stuart's parents, Grandma and Grandpa Gelman. And they're kind of all moving through this awkwardness of this time frame as this transition is happening. We also have Caroline's family as well. We have Emmy, Jackie, and Joe are her kids. Emmy is kind of the oldest daughter of the family. And then we also have her friend Dottie as well, who is also kind of a housekeeper and is sort of pushing her often because Dottie is like going to school and getting an education. And Caroline is just trying to kind of get by and do the best that she can for her family in this job. So there's some friction between them about those two different modes of life. The inciting incident of kind of why we're focused on them in this particular time is Rose has a slight annoyance that she moves into and tries to fix around Noah. Noah continuously leaves change in his pocket. And Rose is kind of concerned that he's like kind of without structure right now and doesn't really know the value of money. And so she comes up with this plan that she hopes will kind of discipline Noah to not leave his change in his pocket anymore. And she kind of thinks will help Caroline a bit out. And to what degree Caroline wants her help seems to be kind of low, but she goes for it anyway. And she tells Caroline to start taking the money that's in the change pocket, in the pockets of Noah, not giving it back to him, but like helping him learn some consequences for leaving change in his pocket. Some back and forth happens around that, and we'll talk about, we'll get into the details later. I'm going to just continue at a cruising pace over this play. So this kind of continues to develop. More and more change is left, and Noah starts to pick up that the change is being taken by Caroline, and he starts to sort of intentionally leave change in the pocket because he loves Caroline, and he wants to try to figure out some way to kind of join her family. There's a really kind of compelling song where he sings about what it would be like to be in Caroline's family. And Caroline is starting to realize that this this influx of change is actually helping quite a bit. She's able to take care of her kids a little bit more, take them out and get stuff that they want. And so she starts to kind of see the appeal of this influx of kind of unexpected money. All of this comes to a head, though, eventually, because the Stopnik grandfather arrives in town for Hanukkah. This is Rose's father who kind of comes down into town to have Hanukkah with the family. And there is a kind of a big moment where Hanukkah happens. There's also a great a kind of clash of ideals between Grandpa Stopnik and Emmy, who's there kind of helping with this larger meal. Again, Caroline's daughter, Emmy. And so they kind of have this conflict of ideas, both of who they're both excited about it. Caroline is immediately kind of like, this is not the way we should be behaving. Emmy, you're going home. Get out of here. Even though Mr. Stopnik is like, actually, this is the best conversation I've had in a while. Emmy doesn't leave. Eventually, Caroline does leave as a result of that.
And Emmy and Caroline get into it, really, about Caroline's sort of, Emmy's perspective is that Caroline just sort of keeps her head down and doesn't, you know, work for a better world, is the young Emmy's point of view. And the conflict between Caroline and Emmy gets pretty heated to the point of a slap. And so Caroline has that sort of on her conscience as she storms out of this house.
Yep, and Emmy has on her conscience some of the words that she says. She kind of derides Caroline for the position she's taken and not working for more change in the world. The event that happens at this Hanukkah celebration is a gift from Grandpa Stopnik to Noah of the amount of $20.
A lot of money back then.
Yeah, to put it in perspective, Caroline is making $30 a month working for the Gelmans. It's a lot of money back then. And so Noah kind of takes the gift. There's some delightful awkwardness with Grandpa Stopnik throughout much of this scene that Rose tries to get in the way of, or like keep on a down low a little bit. But eventually Noah kind of leaves with the money. And the next day at school, he's starting to dream about like ways that he's going to use it, what sorts of ways he could maybe spend it on things that he wants, etc. And he makes the realization that he left it in his pocket, and that it's going to the laundry. And we see over, you know, in the basement, Caroline has found the $20 bills and has to make the decision. All along, she's had this kind of tense decision about, like, do I take money from this kid? Is this actually something that I should be doing? And kind of through the constant requests from Rose to do it, she has been eventually taking, and through the seeing what it has enabled her to do for her family as well. So Noah rushes home. She's already taken the 20, and she kind of holds the line at first of like, no, you lost it. This is the rules. I took it already. And this like sends Noah off the deep end. And he kind of like says that he'll tell on her, says that he'll, you know, he wants it back. He needs it back. Caroline says, you're not going to get it back. And eventually Noah is kind of the first one to kind of descend into this like violent threat against Caroline and against black folks who are there.
Threat. Yeah. One of the racial insults, accusations, violence at the time was this idea that when President Johnson took over, he was going to do a great amount of violence against the black people in the country at the time. It was this sort of common thread from the more radicalized side of white America.
Yep. So he kind of like repeats that from wherever he had heard it in this moment of anger, which prompts Caroline's own moment of anger, where she essentially says all Jewish people are going to end up in hell. And so you have this like this relationship kind of fall apart in this moment. Caroline takes out the 20, kind of gives it back to him. Here's your 20. We're never going to talk again, essentially. And she leaves. And kind of the next set of days are this kind of tense time where she leaves for something like 5 or 6 days, for sure. Like 5 days go by, maybe a week goes by. And she kind of deals with whether or not she's going to come back. Rose deals with some guilt about maybe her role in kind of setting this out. Her dad, Grandpa Stopnik, doesn't really help allay any of that guilt. In fact, he kind of drills some of it home. What it kind of culminates in is Caroline and Dottie having a follow-up conversation where Dottie says, you have to figure out a way to change. And all along this time, Caroline has been talking about how she's kind of locked away this time of her life when her husband, Larry, former husband, Larry, kind of went away to war and came back and couldn't find work and ended up kind of descending into drinking and some real kind of physical abuse of that, even though that she loved him very much. There was not a way forward for them with the amount of abuse there. So she's been kind of like dealing with going back to that while she's having this way forward of supporting her family. And her kind of like big culminating song is about like, is the money worth it for what it's doing to me? I want to go back to where I was before I let the money kind of do this. And it's a question that she kind of like continues to ask throughout that song. So, to wrap it up and get to our conversation, eventually she does return back to work. There is sort of a connection point for her and Noah, where Noah like kind of avoids her the first day, but calls out the window down to her as well. And there's this kind of like tense sort of a renewing of their relationship and a hope that maybe they'll kind of build towards it by the end. There's so much more, though, that's going on in this play. The washer sings. The dryer sings. There's a bus that sings.
I do want to just note, though, before we finish up with that the end is Emmy, who tells us that she was part of the group that toppled the statue. So she has been involved in some sort of counter-protest in terms of activism. And then the other Thibodeau children come out and they basically say, you know, it's up to us to make a better world. That kind of heartbreaking end for Caroline's song is this, the prayer song that you described, what has the money done to me? It sort of ends with Caroline saying, like, take away, you know, to God, sort of take away my hopes and dreams. I can't afford them. Which is, it's a heartbreaking end for this character in this particular story. But then I think it is the children stepping forward and saying, because of the work, the life that our mother has given us, we are going to be the ones to make change. So I think that's the direction the musical is hoping your sort of hope-filled heart leads, but there's no denying that Caroline's final prayer with God is quite tough. Hard. I mean, this is absolutely one of the lines, and not like an early line. This is like a late line in the song. This is like where she's landed after singing through this thought process. She says, "Take Caroline away, because I can't be her. Take her away, I can't afford her. Tear out my heart, strangle my soul, turn me to salt, a pillar of salt."
Yeah.
So some biblical imagery there, of course.
Certainly. Yeah, and throughout the play, just be thank you for bringing up the kind of epilogue scene. It doesn't feel like an epilogue scene. It seems feel very important scene, but it is titled epilogue, where Emmy kind of like notes that her role in the toppling of the statue, that's seated very early in the play. It almost, for much of the play, it feels like an afterthought, but it kind of comes around at the very end in a really impactful way of like, early on, we hear that there's some drama going on, someone like stole a statue and no one can find it. And then we find out, oh, they found it was in the bottom of the river, but the head was off of it. And so kind of slowly throughout the play, we're wondering sort of about that, all the while paying a lot of attention to the family. And then it turns out that Emmy was a part of this kind of overthrow, this call for change, and her kind of last song monologue, soliloquy, I guess. Although eventually her brothers do come out and sing with her, so I guess it's not a soliloquy. But there is this focus on the next generation taking over and implementing perhaps the change.
And it's that, right? It's change. I mean, the musical is titled such that your brain perks up at words or ideas of change. And that ends up, I mean, being a really sort of nice pun, play on words to drive the show. I mean, in part, this is a show about a time of change in the country, right? JFK has been murdered. Martin Luther King Jr. is marching. The South and the North, represented by these different parts of the Gelman family, are at odds about a number of things. Confederate statues are being beheaded, right? So it's about a time of change in the country, racially and economically. And it's about, and also, in some ways, a time of change in the family, right? This unfortunate passing of the mother, this new Rose coming in. But it's also about one of the, as the central character, the other characters in this musical ask Caroline whether she is willing to change. And her friend Dot sings a really, I found a very moving song about what it costs you to change as an adult. Dot is going to like a college at night to better her life. And Emmy, of course, is constantly upset with her mother, Caroline, for not doing what Dot is doing. But in a very painful reveal at the end of the musical, Dot says, when you're an adult and you're going to force yourself through that kind of change, it's not easy. It's in fact incredibly painful. It hurts to relearn to move yourself in a different direction at this point in our lives, our being her and Caroline's.
Yeah. And that's that like, it's hard. Certainly in that scene, Caroline kind of reacts to that push by Dot to change in some way and says, you need to get off my lawn, and we're done. And there is like so much of that tension of like, is it even, it's like that this pain, this what it'll cost to change is there. For Dot, it's worth it. For Dottie, it's worth it. But the kind of question for Caroline is, that really hard last song of like, is it actually worth it to change or not? Or can I just like continue along as I used to do before? And is that going to be the best way to support my kids so that they can bring about the change that they are going to bring about?
And it's Caroline's hardness and toughness. And that's not an interpretation by me. That's what she says of herself that really, it seems like it is a defining self feature for her. She, very early in the musical, her refrain is, "I'm tough, I'm mean." And it's sort of the answer to why she's not going to take this extra change, right? Is like, I'm not taking change from a kid. I'm too tough. I'm too mean for that, right? Like, I'm world-hardened in a way that makes me practical, that makes me driven, that pushes me to do what I need to do for my family. And then, after the act break, when we come back into Act Two, the very first thing that happens is we learn Caroline's sort of life history, especially her relationship with her former husband. And as you say, her former husband came back from Japan and ended up drinking and jobless and ended up punching her. And the story Caroline tells, with the help of the washing machine and the dryer and the radio, is that Caroline basically says to herself at that moment, that's never going to happen again. And she becomes tough and mean in response to that. And the next time her husband hits her, she beats the snot out of him. And that's how she tells the story. And he runs away, and that's why he's gone. She just beats him up. And that's the kind of, I think if I say that's the kind of person that Caroline is, that's not quite what I mean. That is how Caroline sees herself, I think.
Yeah.
And so this, you know, question asked by Rose, by Dot, by Noah, by Emmy and the other kids, you know, Caroline, is this your life? Are you going to change your life, or are you going to, as the metaphor goes, drown in the basement of the house, right? It's I love that metaphor of the sort of Louisiana soil being filled with water, right? The musical opens. There's no underground in Louisiana. Nobody has basements. This particular family is like the only basement in the whole town. But the idea that underground is where you drown. And so Caroline, because she works in a basement primarily all day, is in danger of drowning there. Maybe not literal physical danger, but emotional danger.
Yeah, definitely. The kind of last song, again, one of the like really impactful songs. If you see any sort of ad work for this play, if they include a song, they often include this song around like slamming the iron down. That's I feel like, yeah, she's definitely like kind of singing about how she views herself, and she says, "What did God give me this arm for, if not to do this?" So yeah, there is that, and there is this kind of like sadness of having to be, you know, undergrounds in the drowning, but also like, and not, but also, and there is a there's another line in that song talking about how she names how strong people are going on marches and doing the work of civil rights and things like that. But she says that no one is as strong as me, and so I will go back and continue to slam the iron down. So yeah, there is also
and Noah uses that language too throughout the musical. Caroline is stronger than my dad, stronger than you, he says to Rose. Caroline's strength is a negotiated factor in the musical. And I think that ending prayer with the iron, with the take Caroline away from me, I think you see what that strength costs.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I think part of what this musical does is say, like, okay, the sort of myth of America is like the strength of the poor, right? Oh, they just endure. They're going to work hard and tough it out, right? Oh, and even like the more liberal point of view is like, oh, they're so strong for doing that. What,
sure.
what courage it takes, what strength to do that. And I think that is the one of the myths that this musical questions, that that strength costs you. It costs yourself in some way. And in order to be that strong, quote unquote, what Caroline has to do in that ending prayer is, you know, the metaphor of slamming the iron into herself, sort of beating the sword into shape, you know?
Yeah.
And it is not a free endeavor to be strong.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And it's and then it's I love that there's kind of one more song that she sings after that kind of like proves the fact that there's also like there is a cost, and there is like real grief going on for her as well. Every other character prior to this kind of last moment, right before the epilogue, where she's singing with Noah, has expressed some grief over this absent Betty. And you don't really know exactly to, we don't get, like, there's no ghost scene. There's no, like, memory scene. Like, we don't meet Betty in this play. We just see the whole.
The only thing that I would say about that, about is, and I'm not musical enough to be able to tell this, maybe you are, or maybe one of our audience members is, the Betty was a musician, Stuart is also a musician, Stuart plays the clarinet, there's clarinet throughout the musical. What I don't, I'm not good enough to identify if there is any prevalent bassoon. And if there is, I would say that Betty does come back as a sort of auditory ghost.
That's true, yeah.
But I don't know that well enough to be able to identify it.
Yeah, there's absolutely, you're spot on. There's absolutely moments where the bassoon kind of plays a motif and comes in. Sometimes it kind of weaves. There's a lot of scenes. We probably won't have time to get to how many scenes, like what Stuart is going through. like, there's a lot of scenes with Stuart playing the clarinet, and a lot of those scenes do have a bassoon kind of floating through it. I think, at least, I didn't read the sheet music, but it sounds to me as if it's true.
Sure.
But also, in this last song, Caroline specifically brings up the bassoon.
Yes.
And she kind of, it's like, she's talking to Noah about, what it's like to be underwater.
Because, let me just set that up, because the other way the underwater metaphor is used, and this is how you know the writing is good, right? There's a
sure,
metaphor established.
Everywhere.
Everybody can establish a metaphor. Anybody who's worth their salt as a writer can do a metaphor. That's the easy part. The hard part is using a metaphor in more than one way. That's what's incredible. And so in this musical, you see it all over. The underwater metaphor is used throughout, including Noah's constant concern that because there's no underground in Louisiana, there's only underwater, right? That's the metaphor. Well, if his mother's dead, what happens when you're dead? You get buried. And so Noah has this sort of running fear that his mother is underwater in Louisiana, buried in the soil. Now, he ends up resolving that with Rose when she tells him that, of course, if you've been to Louisiana, you know, they don't really bury people. They build these sort of mausoleum things, these above-ground burial shelters. So that is where the Noah's underwater question doesn't come from the same place as Caroline's. But as you're about to describe, Jackson, in answering Noah's question, Caroline tells us something about her question.
Yeah, definitely. And she tells, she kind of responds to Noah's question around what it's like to be underwater. But she said, one of the lines she says is it's like the wooden sound of your mama's sad bassoon. And so and she kind of, in this monologue, she lets us know kind of for the first time in the script, really, from Caroline, how much she misses Betty. So that like really kind of, brings it back around to like what this, the grief of this crew of folks is going through. But also like to the very end, Noah asks, and sharing cigarettes, do you miss sharing a cigarette? And she says, you bet I do, Noah. And that, again, another double metaphor in there, because sharing cigarettes with Betty obviously could have happened, but also there's also their relationship as well, that they kind of shared this moment of a cigarette as well. So there is a longing for that too.
And really, it's the first, like, sort of moment of kindness from Caroline to Noah, which sounds a little accusatory, but again, that part of how Caroline sees herself is, like, sort of tough exterior, hard to the world, and she admits over and over in the musical that she's never nice to Noah. It's not her job to be Noah's caretaker. She's not hired as a nanny or something. So she's not really nice to him, but their relationship develops regardless, and this is a moment where she actually does reach out and, like, comfort him a little bit. I want to talk about that, to continue on with the change conversation. Of course, we've talked about internal change, the question of whether a person can change, whether like external poverty circumstances make it more difficult to change. Like all that is questioned in the musical. And brilliantly, it's questioned through spare change, right? So that's the change pun. For one of the classes that I teach, I ended up talking about this music a little because I think it's this really stellar example of a feature of drama writing that we've worked on, is this idea that to develop an interesting character with an interesting problem, one way to do that is to give them a goal, right? And then create a list of things they would not be willing to do to achieve their goal, for moral reasons, for self-identity reasons, right? And then, of course, good stories force characters to do things they would not otherwise do to achieve their goals. That's what makes it hard to achieve their goals. It's what forces them to change. It's what makes it, you know, problematic. All this great stuff from stories. Some of it comes out of just that simple construction. Give them a goal, the things they're not willing to do to get that goal, and then force them through the story to do those things. What's great about this musical is that it is a perfect example of that. Because Caroline wants to provide for her family. That is what she does, right? She is the provider. She's got three children at home. She's got another son off in Vietnam. So she is the provider, wants to provide for her family. The thing she's not willing to do to achieve that is to take money from a little boy. Right? As soon as Rose comes down and says, you should just keep the change you find, Caroline's like, I'm not doing that. Right. I'm not stealing money from like an 8-year-old. Like, that's not happening. And then, of course, what happens? Because it's a good story. Circumstances, other characters' decisions, all that stuff put Caroline in a position where she starts to be willing to do that. It starts with just coins, right? If there's coins left, I'll keep them. But the first time a dollar bill comes around, no, I'm not willing to do that. But then things start happening. Okay, fine, I'll take the dollar bill, right? And then that resolves itself in the big conflict of the late part of the musical. Now it's not just a dollar, it's a $20 bill. And then, the great writing is, of course, that happens from the flip side, too. What is Noah willing to do to establish a relationship with Caroline? He's willing to give her spare change. He's even willing to give her a dollar. But he's not willing to give her the $20 bill. That's a lot of money. It's this big thing from his grandpa. And that's the thing that becomes the negotiation tactic. We see Caroline change over the musical because we know from the beginning she's not willing to do this, but then she is a little. Then she is a little more. And then the big question is presented to her. Is she willing to or not do this thing? And that is such like simple, beautiful character writing. Caroline does something she is not otherwise willing to do, and that's what we want to see from stories, you know.
And it's set up so well because of its repetition, because of the journey that we go on with it. When a new thing shows up, we're kind of already we're ready for it. When the 20 shows up, there is this like. Noah just got a 20. It's certainly going to end up in the laundry.
Of course. You're totally right. The moment that he opens the gift and it's a 20, every person knows what's going to happen. At that point, the course is set. And it's part of the drama. We see, okay, now this is it.
And the moment that it arrives too is one that is fraught, right? It's the scene where Emmy and Grandpa Stopnik are arguing. It's this big dinner. It's this scene where Emmy and Carolyn are arguing, and there's all of this angst going on. And so when the 20 shows up, you're set up, you're ready to go. And then when it pays off, there is like both this satisfaction that it did pay off and that we were not like the rug wasn't pulled out from under us or something like that. And then after the satisfaction is the tragedy. You sit there and you watch as it unravels in front of you. And then you're dealing with consequences, and the consequences like again flow out of this as well. You see Noah kind of reel from the loss of Caroline, and then Caroline as well reeling from her own choices and what she's kind of like brought herself to and how she doesn't want necessarily where she's wound up as a result of the choices.
Right. Yeah. I mean, by putting your characters in situations where they are forced to decide with high stakes and high urgency whether or not they're going to do something on their I won't ever do this list, you immediately cause conflict within them. Because it's not easy to decide to do that. So even if they ultimately decide, I really am not willing to do that, as Caroline does, she gives the money back. But it's even that is not an easy choice. And because of that internal turmoil, she ends up doing something that she also would not do, which is use racial, hatred language against this young boy.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, and even that is set up well, because we find out that, I forget, it's either Jackie or Joe has a cavity and needs to go to the dentist. An unforeseen cost has emerged. So it's not just we're going to go and like continue to be able to do things. It's, there's a very present need associated with this $20 bill as well. So there is, there's stakes there as well. In the giving back of it as much as there has been all along. And what it can do for her and her family.
Definitely. I think we should spend a lot of the rest of our time talking about the inanimate objects, but I do want to note one other, just really, I think, lovely complicating factor of this musical. So Rose's father from New York City comes, right? And he is like a revolutionist, sort of a communist revolutionary is his political ideal. So he and Emmy, they get in this clash, of course, about Martin Luther King's sort of Christian nonviolence versus the sort of like overthrow the you know, the proletariat, or the bourgeoisie, rather. The proletariat overthrows the bourgeoisie. They get in this political conflict, but that's his political point of view, right? I only bring that up to mention Rose, once Caroline has disappeared, Rose is in some conflict with Noah, and she and her father have, I think, a really interesting conversation where her dad basically says, "You are Caroline's boss." And he accuses her, basically, even subconsciously, he recognizes, of using the the idea behind the change thing being to cause conflict between Caroline and Noah, because she was jealous of how close Noah was to Caroline. He questions the real motive behind her. And he also brings into question this idea that Rose has throughout the play, which is, I can just be friends, even though I have a position of power. And if you're a person that has any positions of power, you know that it, you know, those relationships are fraught with, you know, even unconscious abuse of that power. It's why more and more these days we're putting protections around having power, around how you can use power. And I love the small political question that I think is posed there. And it's not that Rose is being accused of being a bad person or anything like that. But I think her father pretty aptly calls into question her idea that I can just help out and we can be friends and there's nothing else going on. And I think he really says to her, are you sure that's true? Are you sure that's true?
Yeah, there's two really compelling triangles in this, in the kind of like sub area, not even sub area, but like at least for our conversation today, will be sub area of Rose and Noah and Caroline. And I think you've talked about that, and Grandpa Sopnik kind of jumps in and like addresses that directly. There's a really great triangle too between Rose and Stuart and Noah, that they are trying to navigate, because Stuart can't connect anymore because he's lost kind of his access to love. And so he can't connect to Rose and he can't connect to Noah. And Rose is knows Noah's in pain, is trying to help, but is also trying to get Stuart to like love her. So there's two really compelling triangles there too. A lot of great music around that as well.
Yeah. And I mean, it again, to go back to the change thing, it's like, how smart is the writing that it's about cultural change, it's about individual change within Caroline and within the family, and the way that all those three things are brought together into one conflict is around like spare change from your pocket. I mean, just really, really smart there. But the other thing that goes on in this musical is, as you said earlier, and I dodged away from at that moment, like the washer and dryer are characters who sing, who negotiate with Caroline. The radio is this really lovely chorus that sings, that parrots, that talks. The bus, the moon, the world around these characters speaks to them and lives in their ear and in their head.
There's a lot of great, like, kind of spectacle generated from these characters. A lot of the big numbers involve these characters. But also, I think the most compelling ones, certainly the bus is a cool one, but the most compelling ones for me are the washer and the dryer, because they're two really distinct voices. And they kind of weigh in at very particular times and in different ways. I would want to like really make a study of it to like say that this is the archetype that this one holds and this is the archetype that the other one holds. But regardless, the washing machine chiming in and the dryer chiming in, and then the moon above being this like operatic, like soaring, ethereal call to something more often. All of these like sort of like unreal, pseudo real, supernatural maybe, characters, are woven throughout the play to the point that like, I even as you said earlier that we both said, like, give it a listen. I was like, well, That's true. I was helped by the script to know which one was singing when, because it does matter who because they kind of chime in with these like below the skin level critiques, almost like interior monologues for the characters that kind of chime in and lead them towards one thing or another.
Yeah, I think it is a really nice landscape because the play, the story itself is pretty human, character based, good bad choices based, but of course it's also a musical, so there's also this feature that the characters are singing everything, and I find all this sort of extra real stuff, not that it wouldn't happen in a straight play, of course it does all the time, but it ended up being sort of part of the fabric of the like inner life of these characters coming out through their songs. The characters regularly are in dialogue, in negotiation with each other, and then step out to the audience to give us their internal monologue. And I ended up sort of experiencing the washer, dryer, radio, moon, bus stuff as a version of that, as a sort of unzipping sometimes of the characters and sometimes just like weirdly of the fabric of the world around them.
Yeah, especially I would want to like do a really careful look at this to be sure if this is right, but certainly a lot of them, the times that they chime in, are in conversation with Caroline. Give us a window into kind of Caroline's perspective.
Yeah.
And so because so much of Caroline's work that she does and how she presents herself to the world with this strength has to do with her like sitting on what she would really like to say in order that she is so she's able to kind of continue to support her family, to continue to achieve the goals that she's set for herself. It would be hard without like, you know, an aside monologue or something like that to get access to that. But the washer and the dryer always being around, the radio always being around, there's always a way to kind of like check in with what's going on with Caroline and hear kind of what's under the surface as she kind of weaves her way through these complicated moments.
Yeah, and it also, I think, tells us something about Caroline that she has spends so much time, energy, emotional effort, all that in this basement that the, you know, I don't know that it's like really true in her experience of the world that the washer, dryer, radio like speak to her in some sort of like psychotic break kind of a way. But I think it is a representation of the personality and the influence these things have in her day-to-day existence because of the time put into them. And the bus itself, you know, she rides the bus every day to get to and from work. And the moon, she comes to work while the moon is still up. She leaves while the moon is still up. Part of it is it tells us about the nature of her day-to-day existence.
Yeah, for sure. In a really, really evocative way and a really fun way, too. All of the characters when they come on are these like breaks from the they often come with news of some sometimes they come with news, I guess, but they're breaks from the action a little bit like you give your brain a chance to go like, oh, ho, a bus is coming through the gates of hell. So like there's these like great moments to kind of appreciate the spectacle, but in a way that like continues to move access to the character and access to move access to the character closer and then also move the plot forward.
100%. I think that's probably all the time we have today, despite the fact that we've barely scratched the surface of this one. Caroline or Change is truly excellent. Ranks very highly for me in terms of musicals. I love that it is musical. The characters are, you know, the clarinet, the radio. I love that music is a feature of the world in which this musical exists. The worst musicals for me are the ones where, like, music is no part of the world, and so for some reason there's just music. So I love that. I love the great, just simple, choice-based story, right? These characters make decisions to work on each other to get their goals. And out of that, the story is created. And then the incredible music is layered on top. Rather than sometimes you find musicals built the other way around. And that's just not my speed. So I am grateful for being able to re-encounter Caroliner Change. Just great.
Yeah, I am as well. Glad for this conversation and glad that the conversation doesn't have to end necessarily yet, though the time of this podcast is done. We'd love to kind of continue the conversation and extend the opportunity for a conversation out to all of you in podcast land. If you have been around, seen, read, enjoyed, listened to Caroliner Change in any way, we'd love to be conversation partners with that, both to one of us, but also on any of the social media pages to kind of be a space that fosters conversation around Blaze. You can find us on Facebook, Instagram, or X at the username at NoScriptPodcast. We also have a Gmail, NoScriptPodcast@gmail.com. Find us on any of those sites. We'd love to keep talking about Caroliner Change with you.
Absolutely. If you've enjoyed this conversation, any of our other conversations from a nearly full season now, please recommend us to your family, your friends, anybody you know that likes theater stories, musicals, conversations about writing. Send them our way. They can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, YouTube, anywhere you find your podcast. And hey, 2 weeks from now, special guest episode. Be back with us for that. We will have more info on that coming, but special guest episode in just a few short weeks. We'll see you then. Till then, that's Jackson. I'm Jacob. This has been No Script, the podcast.